This is Lars. Thanks again for checking out my podcast. Enjoy your day and the show, and let's make America great again.
You got the vaccination?
Yeah.
Are you okay? I mean, you seem, no, it works. Or you know, or the mom and dad, or the neighbor, or when you go to church, or when you're, you know, no, I really mean it. There are trusted interlocutors. Think of the people. If your kid wanted to find out whether or not there's a man on the moon or whatever, you know, something, or, you know, whether those aliens are here or not, you know, who are the people they talk to beyond the kids who love talking about it?
Now, you're right. If you thought that was the voice, the man stumbling and fumbling and bumbling for all his answers during a torturous town hall meeting, if you thought, why, that's the leader of the free world, the commander-in-chief of the United States military, and the president of the United States, Joseph Biden. He was at a town hall last night on the Chicken Noodle News Network, and this is the Lars Larson Show. Welcome to the Radio Northwest Network, serving the Pacific Northwest states of Oregon, Washington, and Idaho with honestly provocative talk for more than the past 21 years. Glad to have you on board today and happy to have you join the best conversation in talk journalism. You can do it a number of ways. Call me up at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. And as always, naysayers go to the head of the line. You can send emails right to me, talk@LarsLarson.com. You can vote in our Twitter poll. Find it two places. On Twitter, of course, at Lars Larson Show. And on our website, if you don't like Twitter, go to LarsLarson.com. You know, I think Joe Biden, by anybody's estimation, has been treated with kid gloves by the mainstream media. So CNN, of course, put a really tough questioner in place for the town hall last night, Don Lemon. In fact, Joe Biden, maybe he was just being nice, but he called Don Lemon one of the best informed journalists in America, which shows you kind of the tenor of where things were going. They put Don Lemon in charge of moderating the town hall. And I guess we should count ourselves fortunate that Donnie didn't have to wear a bib to catch all the slobber that he did on Joe, because he was giving Joe every break in the world. And of course, vaccinations were tops on the agenda. Take a listen.
The various shots that people are getting now cover that. You're okay. You're not going to get COVID if you have these vaccinations.
Now, old demented Joe may have just forgotten, because it happened last week, that a group of 50 vaccinated Democrats flew to D.C. on a private plane from Texas. They were trying to dodge doing their actual jobs back at the Texas legislature. And six out of the 50 came down with COVID. And they managed to infect a member of the White House staff and a staffer for House Speaker Nancy Pelosi. But, you know, maybe they were lying about being vaccinated. Who knows? So his assertion that the vaccine keeps you safe, that one goes in the Pinocchio file. Because just remember, Joe Biden today is practically frantic with the idea to overcome people's vaccine hesitancy. That's the term of art that the doctors and the bureaucrats are using to say, why don't you want to take the shot? Well, they may not remember what Joe Biden was telling folks last fall when he told them, don't trust the vaccine. If you don't believe me, listen to this.
If and when the vaccine comes, and it's not likely to go through all the tests that needs to be and the trials that are needed to be done.
When we finally do, God willing, get a vaccine, who's going to take the shot? Who's going to take the shot? You can be the first one to say, put me, sign me up. They now say it's okay.
Now, Biden admits, he now admits that his own policies have kept people from going back to work. That's a quote from Joe Biden. And then he condescendingly told a small business owner that he had to pay more to compete with the federal government if he wants to hire workers. Can you imagine this? You're in business and Joe Biden says, well, you're going to have to compete with us. We're just going to pay your workers more so they don't want to work for you. Yeah, there's a way to boost the economy. And Biden told CNN last night that businesses and business owners should be paying more in taxes. Listen to that.
Ever think of a time, those of you who are economists, who teach here economics, can think of any time when the middle class did better, the wealthy didn't do really well? I'm not being a facetious now. I'm being deadly earnest. Can you think of any time that's occurred when the middle class does better? I'm tired of trickle down. I come from the corporate state of America. And by the way, I think you should be able to go out and make $1 billion or $100 million if you have the capacity to do it. But ask one thing. Pay your fair share. Just pay your fair share.
Now, I've heard this fair share argument from Democrats for most of my career as a reporter and as a talk show host. They always say fair share. And you say, well, the top 1% in America pay 35% of the entire federal tax bill. And the top 10% pay 65%, two-thirds of the bill. If that's not fair, what do you think is fair? He also says, because they're trying to downplay inflation, they realize the public opinion polls out there right now say Americans are scared to death about inflation. And he said, oh, yeah, prices are rising. But he says, oh, but, you know, the thing is, even though it's a hidden tax imposed by the Biden administration, all this inflation, remember how he promised you wouldn't be paying any additional taxes? That hidden tax is the inflation. And he says, oh, inflation, it's not going to last for very long. Maybe he should talk to Obama's economists, Larry Summers, Jason Furman, people like that. They have been sounding the alarm bells lately, saying you got to be worried about this inflation. But Joe Biden actually claims that massive government spending, he did this in the town hall last night, he plans to spend as much as $6 trillion in borrowed money, that all that massive government spending will make inflation all better. Listen to this.
I seem pretty confident that inflation is temporary, but if you're pumping all of this money into the economy, couldn't that add to...
No, look, here's the deal. Moody's today, when our Wall Street firm, not some liberal think tank, said if we pass the other two things I'm trying to get done, we will, in fact, reduce inflation, because we're going to be providing good opportunities and jobs for people who, in fact, are going to be reinvesting that money back in all the things we're talking about. Driving down prices, not raising prices. And so I sincerely mean this. Prices are up now, and they're up. For example, you're in a position where you're trying to build a house. Try to find 2x4s and lumber. Well, guess what? People stop working cutting lumber. They stopped doing it because the unemployment was so down. Now, all of a sudden, there's this need because people are coming back. And guess what? Instead of paying 10 cents, you're paying 20. I mean, you understand what I'm saying?
Yeah.
It relates to what, in fact, is now needed because we're growing.
Because we're growing? At this point, we still have millions of people unemployed in a country that has millions of open jobs right now. And Joe Biden seems to think that massive government spending is going to fix all of that. The fact is, last night, he just plain sounded confused. And he sounded confused all the way through. And I think at some point, even Democrats, even those of you who voted for Joe Biden, have to admit, this guy is having trouble keeping his thoughts straight. When he says things like, oh, don't worry, if you've got the COVID vaccine, you can't catch the disease, even though six Democrats caught it who flew in to see him and the vice president just last week. Coming up in a moment, you want crazy? What happens when the liberals running a Northwest government decide that a group set up to promote an industry is doing it so well, so their answer is shut it down? We'll get it in the Northwest Nonsense next.
That makes a lot of sense. A lot of nonsense.
Right. You're bloody well right. You know you got a right to sit.
This is the Northwest Nonsense.
How much longer do we have to sit for this nonsense?
No left-leaning, dead fish rapper bias. No mega TV network liberal agenda. Just the cold hard facts from Lars.
Hey, before I go into my commentary today, and I think it's a good one, so you might want to stick around for that, I want to jump to the White House where Joe Biden perhaps is putting words together better than he did last night on CNN. Take a listen.
Even before research confirmed it, you could see it. And there are economic costs for survivors as well. Medical costs, lost productivity from work, and navigating the court system. That's why Victims Compensation Program helped victims and their families cover the costs they've suffered from the crime. There can be counseling and medical bills, lost wages because you couldn't work, paying for temporary housing for a family fleeing abuse, even fixing a broken door kicked down by an abuser. And, you know, the vast majority of children out in the street are the children who are, in fact, the children of abused women. It can also be a long-term support survivors need to heal every
time. So this is the president talking about a crime victim fund that will be set up for people who have been the victims of crime. I think many states already have these things. How this would work at the federal level, I'm not entirely clear on. So let me give you my commentary for the day. I grew up as the son of a forest ranger. That's what my dad did after he got out of the Navy. He's gone now. Back in the days when the, believe it or not, Pacific Northwest actually believed in cutting trees, in making wood products, you know, 2x6s. Joe Biden says 2x4s. He apparently hasn't been involved in building anything like a house anytime soon. But then again, Joe Biden's never had a job in the private sector. But making wood products using one of the best renewable resources in the world, and that is trees. Well, not so much anymore. And Oregon politicians want to kill what's left of the timber industry. Shamia Fagan, she plans to be governor someday, but now she's Secretary of State. She just issued an audit. And it makes the accusation that the timber industry's one big public voice is breaking the law. 30 years ago, lawmakers allowed some of the taxes on timber to fund an organization to promote the timber industry. Now, that makes sense. In fact, you know, we have all kinds of agencies that have some involvement in government. But if you have a tourism agency and it's funded by the businesses like hotels and restaurants, if you have the Creeping Red Fescue Commission, which is in charge of promoting creeping red fescue, if you know what that is, there are lots of those examples. But it's the industry promoting its own industry. What does not make sense is Secretary of State Fagan's audit, which actually criticizes the Oregon forest resource industry because it's been too effective in educating the public. Too effective in promoting forest products, and she claims that the OFRI is breaking the law by being too effective in promoting the industry it was set up to promote. Again, if you've got a Ouija board and a crystal ball and you can figure out why in the world you would criticize an organization for being too effective at promoting the industry that it was designed to promote, please call as a naysayer. I'll be glad to put you on. So Secretary of State Fagan proposes that OFRI add anti-logging members to its board of directors. So you have an agency or a private, it's funded by the government, but it's got private sector connections, and it's designed to promote logging. So you're going to put anti-logging people on the board of directors of a pro-logging organization. Again, if you can make sense of that, call me up, 866-439-5277. And then she wants to prohibit it from even trying to influence the legislature when the legislature takes up anti-logging laws. And then she wants to let the state government decide what kind of message the OFRI can tell the public. I guess censorship is so popular at the White House and on Capitol Hill, and you know about all the things that the federal government is doing to try to censor people and say, well, as Jen Psaki, the president's spokeswoman, said, if you've said anything that we decide is untrue on social media, you should be banned from social media altogether. Well, I guess Shamia Fagan is trying the Northwest version of that. So Oregon loses more of an industry that once provided literally hundreds of thousands of jobs in the Northwest, and we get another state-funded tree-hugging propaganda agency. Anybody think that's a good idea? Call me up. From Facebook, Pat writes in, Lars, I had to write to you this after hearing from my girlfriend. She works for a financial institution, had a woman come in yesterday and deposit 50 unemployment checks for over $15,000. She has the power of attorney for her son, who is incarcerated. And the checks were in his name. I heard you mention on your show last week, if the people at unemployment were checking on any of these claims to see if they're legitimate, apparently they're not. Just another example of how our tax dollars are being wasted. Love the show. I've been listening for years. Signed, Pat. And then from email, Marvin heard what we said about Joe Biden's confusing performance on CNN. He says, Lars, where I am in Mist, Oregon, the logging hasn't slowed down. The mills are running. The trees are being cut by state and private. Come on, Joe, get caught up on what's going on. Because Joe Biden said, well, the reason we don't have lumber is that the mills have stopped working. No, actually, they can't find the truck drivers to drive the finished product to the store. So that's another question. Let's go to our daily grill now.
Insane.
Are you completely insane?
Ridiculous.
They get more and more ridiculous.
Flat out dumb.
You're even dumber than I thought.
Who deserves today's Lars Grill of the Day?
Maybe they're just really, really stupid.
Find out right now.
Brought to you by Les Schwab Tire Centers. Doing the right thing matters.
I actually love it when the Daily Grill is suggested by an emailer, and I love it even more when the emailer is a naysayer. So Ray wrote in. He said, Lars, you know I don't often agree with you, but there is one thing that you and I agree on, and that's that our local elected officials in Portland are essentially morons and only worried about their own agenda and keeping their jobs in power. I'm not sure if you've seen the Instagram page called Portland Looks Like, and then I have to say blank because I can't say that word on the air, but apparently Ted Wheeler finds the Instagram page inhumane and cruel to the homeless community. I've seen the Instagram page. I've seen the video. We've talked about it on this show. He says, Ray goes on, I like to work in Portland. I actually own a business. And the amount of crime and just general trashy homeless people that we deal with every day is way out of control. I'm pushing 40 years of age, but I've worked in Portland on and off and lived in Portland for the past two decades. The city is in a shambles, and that is truly heartbreaking to me. I can't begin to describe how much I dislike Ted Wheeler, and I'm blown away that Wheeler has the time to criticize a social media page for essentially documenting what we all see in Portland instead of doing his job. A crazy thought, I know. Personally, I think our elected officials are sort of conducting an experiment to see how many liberals they can turn into Republicans, because the longer they do nothing, the more likely people will be more conservative. I read the story earlier today. I couldn't help but think it would be more content for your show. Well, Ray, as a matter of fact, great minds think alike. We talked about that story in WWeek.com, Willamette Week, about the Instagram page that says Portland looks like blank. And we did talk about it quite a bit. Today's best email brought to you by River City Environmental, the leading environmental and emergency services company in the Northwest, now hiring with full benefits, leading pay and a signing bonus. Online, rivercityusa.com/careers. Jim says, Lars, I've been saying this since the start. We start letting people live on the streets. The majority of them are drug addicts. All the city is doing is enabling them to continue their habits. In the past, if you were a drug addict and you got to the point where you were homeless, you had hit rock bottom, and the direction from there is straight back up. Coming up in just a moment, we're going to talk about the efforts to sabotage the Oregon Forest Resource Institute, and we'll talk about it with a guy who actually knows how to cut down trees. Up next on the Radio Northwest Network. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show and the Radio Northwest Network on a Conspiracy Theory Thursday. As I said, I have a bit of a dog in the fight. I grew up all over the Pacific Northwest. My dad was a forest ranger. He worked for the U.S. Forest Service back in the day when the Forest Service believed in growing trees for multiple use. They use that phrase to mean that you could be logging, you could do mining, you could do recreation in the forest, you could do hunting and fishing and hiking and all those other things, but you could also do some profit-making activities that generated jobs and supplied the kinds of things that we need. So now we've got the Secretary of State of Oregon, in this case, Shamia Fagan, who's attacked the Oregon Forest Resource Institute and said it is too good at promoting the industry that it was set up to promote using taxes that are collected from the industry it's trying to promote. And that, well, the perfect guy to talk about that is Mike Peel, who you've heard on this program before, because he actually knows something about the timber industry, because he cuts trees for a living. Mike, welcome back.
Thank you. Very glad to be here.
By the way, don't let me pass by the opportunity to let you promote an event that's coming up this Saturday involving helping out some farmers, the people who grow, you go for the big trees, they go for the little plants, the wheat and all, and you got to make sure that they stay supplied. But tell me what we should make of the idea that an institute set up to promote the timber industry, your industry, is now under attack because it was too effective and they want to put a bunch of tree huggers on its board of directors.
So let's start out with OFRI. It's Oregon Forest Resource Institute. So I Googled resource, and that word, the definition means provide, which means provide a natural resource that we can actually use, that we need, and provide jobs. So just the terminology of OFRI means provide, and by them putting tree huggers on board, and it's also funded by timber tax. We are paying for it. As loggers, timberland owners, why would we work against ourselves? So, and then I watched the public announcement, and they spent half the time thanking themselves. It's just, I can't believe it.
Well, and what's amazing to me is they say they want to ban Ofri from having input when, say, the state legislature decides to pass laws that will be that would be negative toward the timber industry. Now, I know there are some people who say, well, maybe we should have some laws. Well, Mike, I imagine you operate under a huge framework of law of laws. When you go out to log, in terms of protecting the environment, protecting streams, protecting fish, and everything else. And now, if the legislature wants to pass a law that will shut down logging, they don't want the logging industry to have any input on that law. Does that make sense?
Well, I agree with what you just said. I mean, we have a whole book of laws that we have to abide by, which are actually good. And even if they weren't there, we would be self-policing. Why on earth would we destroy what our backyard is? I mean, we're all about, you know, perpetual, you know, so we want to take care of things, get it replanted. You know, sometimes we have to, but yeah, we want to take care of it on our own.
What would you think of the idea that you'll end up paying taxes if Fagan is successful to a group that then is going to work against the best interests of the company, your company, Mike Peel Logging, that you're trying to do? In other words, you'll be paying for the people to shut down your own industry.
So basically, if they do that, they need to find another source of funding, take away from some social program, because there's no way we want to pay for ourselves to be shut down. What's going on here?
How is the timber industry doing right now? You know that Joe Biden went on CNN last night and he said, well, the reason that 2x4s cost more money is because all the mills are shut down and nobody's cutting trees. What's your take on that?
Well, I heard your comment from before, the guy from Mist, Oregon, talking about all the log trucks and everybody making things happen. So out here in the country where the real world is, the rural working Oregonians, things are still hammering down. We were shut down a little bit early for fire season, which is common sense, but all the mills are operating. Everybody's working hard. We're short a few people because there's so many, unfortunately, unemployment programs. We're short of truck drivers. You know, we could use another loader operator or two. But things are still hammering down. There's lots of lumber going up and down the road.
You know, it's funny because I had a lot of people who believe in conspiracies who called me up and said, look, I've driven past the mills. They have stacks and stacks of inventory. And I said, yeah, exactly what Mike Peel just said. A lot of the mills say we've got tons of inventory. We need somebody to take it off to where it's sold, you know, at the lumber yards and the Home Depots and places like that, because they can't ship enough to get it out in a timely fashion. If they could, most of those mills don't want to leave, you know, dimensional lumber sitting in the yard. It doesn't make them any money until somebody actually buys it.
Yes, I met with a large sawmill owner yesterday, and he says they have excess inventory in their yards because they cannot get it to its designation.
Well, I guess Joe Biden could stop paying people not to work, and that might be part of the answer. Now, tell me about this effort your industry is undertaking to try and help out farmers who are in a different part of agriculture.
So us as Timber Unity, we're out there to help. You know, right now we have 63,700 members. We helped during the ice storm. We helped with hay last year for the victims up all the drainages that got burned out. But this weekend, we have Hay for Hope, which we're meeting at the Scales on the Sunset Highway, Highway 26, at 6 o'clock. And actually, I'll have Jen take over from here. She organized it. She's my office gal, so she'll run through the rest of the procedure here.
Very, very good. Jen, welcome to the Lars. Jen, welcome to the Lars Larson Show. How much hay are you going to send down to the farmers with no water in the southern part of the state?
About 350 tons.
Wow.
Yeah.
How many trucks is that?
Oh, my gosh. I can't even keep track. A lot of us are trying to put it together still.
Are you still looking for people to haul it? Are you still looking for people to donate hay? I mean, hay is expensive, as I understand. If you've got livestock, you got to feed the livestock. Are you getting people to just give up the hay to help out their fellow farmers?
We do have people donating hay. We have a lot of members donating funds for us to purchase hay. And we have people just donating their time and bucking it up onto trailers. We have people donating trailers and trucks and just ready to convoy.
Wow, this sounds like it's going to be quite an operation. When does it happen and where?
So it is this Saturday, July 24th. Like Mike said, they're meeting at the Scales on Highway 26 at 6 a.m. And then they're going to be meeting a lot of people down at the Love truck stop in Roseburg at exit 119 off of I-5. And then they're going to take Highway 40 to Highway 39 all the way to Farmer Fred's house in Malin.
Now, Malin is the little town that's just south of Klamath Falls. I used to live in Klamath Falls, and I've had some friends who've lived in Malin over the years. Sounds like you're going to help them out a lot. Is it going mostly to ranchers rather than to farmers, right?
It's going to both. That's our central drop-off location, and then people who need it are going to contact Farmer Fred, and they're going to come pick up what they need to get by.
His name is really Farmer Fred, or is that just what you call him?
That's what everybody calls him. He's the guy with the big blue tarp truck at all the rallies.
Farmer Fred. Well, I'm glad to see you do it. Is there anything else you need, along the way? Because I'm glad to ask people if they can help you out. Sounds like it's going to be quite an event on Saturday.
We just kind of ask if you can't join in on the convoy and go down, that maybe stand on the side of the I-5 or over the overpasses. And when you see us, wave, honk your horns. Fly your Timber Unity signs or American flags, and let's just help everybody.
Absolutely right. Thank you so very much, ma'am.
Yeah.
You betcha. That's Mike Peel and his, as he calls him, office girl, that they're going to have a big Timber Unity event to bring 350 ton of hay all the way from, well, the northern end of the state to the southern end of the state to help out the farmers. As you know, the federal government decided to cut off the water down there. Coming up in a moment, why has one Northwest official decided that removing people from filth and squalor and drug use and homeless camps in Washington is not humane? We'll get into that and your calls, too, at 866-HEY-LARS. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show and the Radio Northwest Network. It is a pleasure to be with you. We're adding to the network all the time. New affiliates coming on board around the Pacific Northwest. Now 24 stations that carry this program out to Oregon, Washington, and Idaho. And we try to return the favor by supplying honestly provocative talk radio. I'll get to that homeless subject in just a moment. Our Twitter poll today: should the taxpayer ever fund a political advisor for elected officials? And I'd say hell no to that. But consider this. Governor Kate Brown of Oregon is on track to spend more than $100,000 in taxpayer funds for one of her longtime advisors to serve as a part-time political consultant. Under an arrangement dating back to early 2020, Brown hired her former communications director, Chris Payer, through a no-bid state contract at a rate of $6,500 a month, so that he could attend weekly meetings of the Western Governors Association. If there are meetings of the Western Governors Association, shouldn't the governor be going to those meetings? Or expanding electric vehicle infrastructure, which is the governor's signature initiative during her time as chair of the group. Yeah, consider this. Kate Brown wants you to start driving an electric car, just as the Northwest Regional Power Planning Council is forecasting blackouts and brownouts, a 32% chance of such by 2023. So 18 months from now, we're going to be running short of electricity for the things we already power with electricity. And Kate Brown wants to have more electric vehicle infrastructure, and she thinks it's worthwhile to give somebody $6,500 a month to go to meetings so she doesn't have to go to the meetings and to talk about ways to expand electric vehicle infrastructure. Should the taxpayers ever fund a political advisor for elected officials? Answer the question any way you like. My answer is no. At Lars Larson Show or at LarsLarson.com. And always brought to you by Ultimate Truck Services. If you rely on trucks for business, Ultimate keeps your biggest assets on the road and running right. Find them at UltimateTruckService.com. Yesterday, I asked you this: should the state decide what kind of bag a store can give you, the customer? I said no. So did 90% of you. Only 10% of you said yes. That effectively makes that 10% naysayers, and I'd be glad to hear their argument for why the state should get involved in deciding what kind of straw, what kind of cup, what kind of bag, what kind of any of that you can buy at a store if the merchant chooses to give it to you. Now, I want you to consider something else. Earlier this week, I told you there had been a horrendous number of attacks. I would call them attempts at murder, where people, and this was mostly in the Seattle area near I-90, Someone began throwing rocks or chunks of concrete over the last several months, 161 instances. And when these rocks hit the windshield of a car going by at 50, 60, 70 miles an hour, if it punches through the windshield, the person inside is going to be at least seriously hurt, if not dead. Thankfully, there have been no deaths. So what happened, and I suspected, and I gave you my theory on it yesterday, that if people living in these so-called homeless camps, which is a prettied-up term for people who are, for the most part, addicted to drugs, addicted to alcohol, and in some cases mentally ill, and you say if you take antisocial people who've worn out their welcome with their families, they can't live with family, they've worn out their welcome with their employers, they've worn out their welcome with their friends, they're no longer couch surfing at their friend's house, and they're now living in a tent by the side of the freeway. And then one of them, or a number of them, decide that it might be fun to start dropping rocks on people and try to murder them. Well, at that point, WSDOT, the Washington State Department of Transportation, said, well, maybe we should clear those encampments out. And they say they plan to start doing it today. But here's where it gets kind of strange. WSDOT Secretary Roger Miller says that because those encampments pose a public safety risk, and it's now turned into a criminal matter, they will be cleared out. But speaking to the Washington State Transportation Commissioners yesterday, Miller says the state has no plans to clear out additional encampments. He says, quote, what we can't do about this homeless camp, whack-a-mole, where you clean up one and they move across the street. That just won't work. It's a waste of resources. And frankly, it's not humane. He says the state is working with cities, counties, and social service providers to provide encampments with bathrooms, dumpsters, access to housing and medical programs. So in other words, people who are not contributing to society, people who are actually a detriment to society, people who engage in antisocial behavior like shooting drugs, dropping dirty needles, using the streets of your city as a public toilet, an open sewer, and now some of them dropping rocks on freeways, that it's inhumane to say you can't live in these conditions anymore. He says the problem is homelessness, and the solution to that problem is homes. We need to create housing. Now, this is where I wish somebody had access to Miller. We're going to ask Secretary Miller to come on this program. I'm not going to hold my breath because many times they don't want to get a question like this. But let's suppose that that the state agencies in both Oregon and Washington said, we're going to clear the path so that private people can build housing, so we have enough housing for everyone. I want you to drive down the street as you see the homeless camps in your town, and I want you to ask yourself this question. If a home was available at an affordable price, you know, $1,000, $1,200 a month for a small apartment, would any of these people living in tents who take almost any of the money they get and they either pour it down their throat in the form of booze, or they shoot it in their arm in the form of heroin, or they smoke it in the form of methamphetamine or fentanyl, would any of these people be able to afford a house or an apartment, even if it was at an affordable rate? I think the answer to that is no. Back in just a moment. You're listening to the Radio Northwest Network and the Lars Larson Show. We'll talk Boeing next. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you, and I have to confess, I've been a nerd since I was a kid. Very interested in science, very interested in spaceflight, back in the infancy of spaceflight, when it was exclusively something done by governments on planet Earth, and of course, done best by the United States of America. So this week, we saw this terrific development. I'm not crazy about Jeff Bezos' political points of view, but I really can appreciate what he did, flying to the edge of space with five other people in a private endeavor. And I said so. I said, I don't have to admire the guy's politics. He doesn't agree with me. I don't agree with him. That's okay. But then I started thinking about some other pioneers, because I'd seen a documentary, and it was really about aviation in general, but it talked about the four men who were at the center of the creation of the entire aviation business. And if I can remember them right, we've got Donald Douglas, who was McDonnell Douglas. That became his company. You've got Bill Boeing. You had Fokker, the guy who created the Red Baron's airplane that allowed the Germans to do so well in World War I, at least in the air. And you had Henry Ford, kind of an unlikely entrant, and wasn't in it all that long. But when I saw the story of Bill Boeing, I thought, I know this story. I know the story of the Boeing airplane company. And yet I didn't. I didn't know all of it. So I thought, I've got to call up Michael Lombardi, who is the senior corporate historian for Boeing, and he joins me now. Mr. Lombardi, thanks a lot for coming on the program.
Yeah, hi, Lars. Thanks for reaching out. Love to talk airplanes with you.
Absolutely. You were featured prominently in this documentary about Bill Boeing, and I guess the connection I saw between Boeing and his history at the very beginning and what Jeff Bezos is doing now is that Bill Boeing, correct me if I'm wrong, when he wrote up the Articles of Incorporation for an airplane company that I think at that point had not made any airplanes yet, he foresaw the day when you would carry cargo and people all over the planet. Is that true?
Right. Yeah, no, absolutely. That was one of the great attributes of Bill Boeing was he was a visionary. And when people still saw the airplane as a curiosity and other than what was going on in World War I, where the airplane was being used and it had a military use, that use to really serve humanity really hadn't come to fruition. But Bill Boeing saw that he really had the vision. He would not be surprised at all with the worldwide airline infrastructure that's out there now. That's the future he saw and predicted.
And in fact, sadly, I know there was a point in the company's history where he passed away just as the company was about to hit some really significant mile markers. But let's go back to the beginning and tell me this. This is a guy who was fascinated by airplanes, but when he went off to, I guess, the first air show that had ever been held in America where people, you know, thousands of people would get together, I think it was California, so that they could actually watch an airplane, just an ordinary biplane, he couldn't get a ride.
That's correct. Yeah. Yeah, that was the 1910 Los Angeles Air Show. It was down at what's now, I think there's a junior college or one of the California colleges at Dominguez Ranch. So it was Dominguez Field. And it was this multi-day affair. Bill Boeing went there, and it was, as you said, the first time he saw an airplane. And some of the great early barnstormers of the day were there, so including Louis Pollan, which was well-known pilot from France, and Bill Boeing could speak French. He had gone to school in Switzerland, Vevey, and so he could speak French with this pilot. And he asked him several times, a couple of days, Mr. Pollan, can I have a ride? And Monsieur Boeing, no, not today. I'm full, and he's come back tomorrow. So the next day, Bill Boeing went fully expecting to get this ride, and Mr. Pollan had left because he had been served papers by the Wright brothers for infringing on one of their patents.
So even in those days.
Even in those days. Yeah, really, things haven't changed. But that inspired him. That moment inspired him to really propelled him, and 6 years later, he started his own airplane company.
He went back to Seattle without ever getting the ride that he wanted. And by the way, let's set the context. These days, everyone knows the word Boeing. I mean, I'll bet you could say it anywhere on the planet, and they say, the airplane company. But at the time, he was a rather substantial figure in Seattle in the timber business, but he wasn't really terribly well known at the time. Is that a fair characterization of the late Bill Boeing?
Right. Yeah, no, that's where he made his wealth. And he is actually, his family is from Detroit, and his father had discovered taconite on their property, and so they were mining taconite. And later Bill Boeing named his yacht the Taconite, and that's where that name comes from. But he was also involved in timber, and his father passed away, and Bill Boeing at an early age decided to make his own way. And to do that, he came out to Grays Harbor, and some family timber and purchased some more and became quite well known and very wealthy in the timber business. And so when you mentioned Bezos and with Amazon that funds his space projects, Bill Boeing had lumber and mining interests that financed his aviation business.
Now, tell me this. I know that there are a lot of people who hate people who've been very successful. I can disagree with Jeff Bezos' politics, as I said I do, but I don't take away from him 1 ounce of what he's done in creating this gigantic company, Amazon. But But then he takes along some passengers, including, I think, one of them who was just given the ride. There were other people who paid. But Bill Boeing did something the same note when he got a contract with the government to start carrying airmail for the first time. And then he told his people, well, you're not going to be able to carry as much mail because I want you to have two passenger seats in the plane. And they, what do you suppose their reaction was at the time? Historically, what does history tell us?
Well, yeah. Well, and first there, you know, I do want to congratulate the folks at Blue Origin and that amazing accomplishment. So,
absolutely.
Yeah, I want to, you know, as an aviation, as an aerospace, like you say yourself, being an av geek, you know, that's so cool. But for the what's interesting is that those first biplanes that Boeing, those mail planes that Boeing started with, the Model 40, as you say, Lars, they had two seats. What's interesting is those seats were first envisioned to carry the mechanics and crew that would be needed to be stationed at these airfields that were across the country. And so, you know, and at this time, what's interesting is that that in 1925, the government passed the Kelly Act, which opened up, you know, up to that point, the post office was flying the mail. And so at that point, the post office let out these airmail routes to private individuals, and Bill Boeing bid on the longest route across the United States, which was in the United States, which was San Francisco to Chicago, and won that bid. And with that mail plane, which was much more efficient than any other, very innovative airplane, he ran it very efficiently, and it was very successful.
We're going to continue this story in a moment. I'm talking to Michael Lombardi, who's the senior corporate historian at the Boeing Company. We'll be back in just a moment. Glad to have you with me, and glad to have you on listening on the Radio Northwest Network. We'll be back in just a moment with Michael Lombardi. You're listening to The Lars Larson Show. Welcome back to The Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you, and I'm glad to take your phone calls and emails, but I want to get to those a bit later because I got the opportunity to talk to Michael Lombardi. And in fact, I have to ask you a personal question, Michael. You're the senior corporate historian for Boeing. How many
Correct.
Big companies in America take the time out to actually have somebody in charge of collecting all the history of the company? You got to be pretty big, don't you?
Yeah, I think I've only got I think I can only count about 80 colleagues across the country.
It's kind of sad, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, from as a historian, and you wish that everybody would keep their history, especially in the aerospace industry. It does seem that way, but it's something I wish more corporations would be interested in. But the big ones, the ones that are been around for a long time, they often do have a historian and a corporate archive.
Well, if you don't mind, let's go back to Jeff Bezos, because, again, the parallels seem really important, that Bill Boeing gets started, gets the airmail contract, decides to put passengers in the plane as well, although the seats were originally, as you pointed out, designed to carry the crew, the ground crew, because you couldn't just fly a plane like you can now and say, wherever I land, almost anywhere I land in America at an airport, I'm going to find people capable of working on the plane. You had to position your own mechanics and such. So he decided to sell these seats. Does that seem very reminiscent of what we saw Bezos do, saying, it's not just going to be me, the billionaire, going into space. I'm going to take five people with me and see if I can sell seats on this thing and maybe make some of it pencil that way?
Yeah, well, and I think that in a bigger way, too, I think and you're absolutely right. There is a parallel to this, that moment in history back in the late 1920s to what's going on now. And that what I see is that you did have these wealthy entrepreneurs like Bill Boeing, very much a pioneer. Bill Boeing was a pioneer of aviation who saw this future for the airplane and invested in it and pushed it along. But it was also with the partnership. There was a partnership with the post office and the Department of Commerce. And today you see that similar pattern where you have you have these entrepreneurs who are pushing this technology along with the support of NASA. And so there's some, I think, and to me, that similarity, that partnership where you have, you know, the government can do some things, but to get those big things done, you know, whether it's starting the airlines or building the arsenal of democracy or going to the moon, the government needs to bring in that partnership. And that's what you see today with NASA working with Boeing and with Elon Musk with SpaceX to make this happen. And because of that, I think you're going to see a similar event in space and low Earth orbit that you saw with the airlines in those early days. It's going to grow.
Because, Michael, when people hear $250,000 or more to be able to take a flight, they say, well, that's out of the reach of almost everyone. I'm sure that at the time that Bill Boeing first started flying his planes, an awful lot of, there weren't a tremendous number of people who could even afford one of those two seats in the mail plane.
Right. And that was, and it really wasn't till the advent of the jet age with the 707 that you saw the opportunity for more people to fly. Where flying finally got to be affordable was when you saw the jets come in. And really, it was the 747 that changed everything because of its size and its economy and range. That allowed anybody, pretty much it was, that marked the time when anybody on planet Earth can get on an airplane and fly anywhere. So the 747 really marks that time. But the 707 really was the time when you saw the price of a flight come down to where just about, you know, most people could afford it. But up until that point, it was fairly exclusive.
Yeah, it was kind of white tablecloth service on the Ford tri-motors and all that. Let me ask you about this, about Bill Boeing's pass. He passed just before the company hit the milestone of the 707, didn't he? Or was it
correct,
just after?
Yeah, and another wonderful parallel there, though. I mean, other than the sad fact that Bill Boeing passed on, when he started the airline in 1927, his wife Bertha christened that very first mail plane that started that first production commercial airplane. And back in those days, it was still prohibition. And she argued for champagne, and of course the law was you couldn't, and it had to be orange juice. And she broke the bottle, and it was orange, but it had a good fizz. So it's up to history, right? Or anyway, fast forward to 1954, and the Boeing company rolls out the Dash 80, the prototype of the 707. And I think locally people remember that famous barrel roll with Tex Johnson over Seafair, that airplane.
Yep.
And when that airplane rolled out, Bertha Boeing was there to break a bottle of champagne over it. So Mr. Boeing got to see that. Bertha repeated this famous christening and launched the jet age. So he did get to see that. He got to see his vision realized, and he got to see where the future of his company was going before he passed. So it was very fitting.
One other piece of context. I'm talking to Michael Lombardi, senior corporate historian for Boeing, and I was just curious about this, so I took the moderator's prerogative and said I want to invite Michael on. Is it fair to say that at the time the 707 was rolled out, the company had pinned its entire hopes on this and a substantial amount of the company's entire worth, and that had the 707 not succeeded as it did and not got into the air, that the company was actually at risk of perhaps just disappearing? I've always heard
right.
that, and I wanted to check it with the guy who knows.
Yeah, no, you're right. And there's actually been a couple of those moments in the history of the company, just about to close the doors forever moments. And one of those, the airplane that saved the company was the famous B-17 Flying Fortress. But you're right, that the Dash 80, the prototype for the 707, the company decided, actually Bill Allen, the CEO of the company at that time, who was voted by Forbes magazine to be the second greatest CEO of the 20th century. It was,
wow.
He made the decision and took this tremendous business risk to really bet the company and put the money into building that prototype without any demand from the customers. The Air Force, the airline customers, nobody was asking for that airplane. But like Bill Boeing before him, he had a vision for the future. He knew that the future was jets, and he was right. And that gamble paid off to what the business that we all enjoy today All of us here that work at Boeing and all of us that have some benefit from Boeing and around the world, people that fly our jets, those great decisions by Bill Boeing and then Bill Allen have given us this wonderful gift of flight.
Well, I so appreciate you taking the time, Michael, and thank you very much. And I'm glad Boeing, like you said, 80 colleagues in the business of being corporate historians, I'm glad Boeing decided to have a man on board who could gather it all put it together, and make it available to people. Thank you so much for the time.
Thank you. Have a-
You bet. Oh, thank you. Thank you very much. That's Michael Lombardi, Senior Corporate Historian for Boeing, and you're listening to the Lars Larson Show. Coming up in just a moment, Nancy Pelosi's rejection of Republicans on the January 6th riot committee. Is that just a purely political move? We'll get into that coming up next. Welcome back to the program. You're glad to get your phone calls at 866-HEY-LARS. You know, if you listen to the show, you know I'm not one for a big one for conspiracy theories, even on Conspiracy Theory Thursday. But I believe since about the 8th or 9th of January of this year, that what happened on January 6th, the riot inside the Capitol building, several hundred people out of the tens of thousands who had come to listen to a speech by Donald Trump that was abundantly peaceful, that this was a bit of a setup, because the FBI announced a couple of days afterward, we've known about the plans for this, this illegal activity at the Capitol for weeks, if not for months. And we warned the Capitol police. And so I thought yesterday, when I heard that Nancy Pelosi had decided that she would not allow two of the best question askers from the Republican Party to even take part in a panel on the January 6th riot that she claims is aimed at finding the truth. You'd think, you want to have good questioners, don't you? Apparently not. She rejected Jim Jordan and Jim Banks. Jordan is from Ohio. Banks is from Indiana. And so the Republicans said, then we're not going to play ball at all. You're not going to have your committee. Noah Weinrich joins me now, who's press secretary for Heritage Action. Noah, I don't know how far down that conspiracy trail you want to go, but I've had people ask me, what do you think happened? I said, I think Nancy Pelosi knew what was going to happen. The FBI says they told the Capitol Police, which answers to Nancy Pelosi. And I think she said, go about with business the way you regularly would on any other day of the week. And there was a riot. And she used that as the predicate for the second impeachment, the historic second impeachment of an American president. Welcome to the show, by the way. And what's your take?
Hey, Lars. Well, that's quite a way to come in. Look, I'll stay away from going too far down the rabbit hole. But what's clear to us, what's clear to me over at Heritage Action, is that Nancy Pelosi is not committed to some sort of objective truth. She's not committed to putting the truth out there or finding the truth. She's not committed to, you know, upholding democracy. And how do we know? We know because on this select committee, which she started and has picked most of the members for already, she said she would allow the Republicans a small minority, 5 members, that Kevin McCarthy would appoint. Kevin McCarthy appointed 5 members, including Jim Banks, the head of the Republican Study Committee, the largest conservative caucus in Congress, and Representative Jim Jordan from Ohio, who is the ranking member. He's the number 2 on the House Judiciary Committee. These are influential members. They're in good standing. And yet Pelosi rejected them. It's not like their votes would sway this committee. She wouldn't even allow them on the committee because she knew they would ask good questions and because she is committed to making this a partisan sham investigation. It's obviously not about finding out any kind of truth. If she was committed to democracy, as she claims, then she would have opened an investigation into what happened last year when rioters tore apart cities, caused billions of dollars in damages, burned down police stations, federal buildings, courthouses, churches, murdered a number of people, including police officers, like police officer David Dorn in St. Louis, yep. Who was killed in an act of arson. Where's the committee for that? There's no select committee for that. There's no congressional investigation into what happened, why, who influenced it, who caused it. There's no investigation. Instead,
but Noah,
she won't even allow members onto this committee.
Well, and Noah, how does she open that box, the box that is January 6th, without these questions being asked? Even if you don't bring in the year and a half of riots that many American cities have seen, you would at least say, well, there was one person who was shot to death during the riot. What do we know about her? Who shot her? Well, we won't tell you. Was he looked at? Was he investigated? No. Did you prosecute him? No. Was there a good reason that he shot Ashley Babbitt? No. How do you open the box of January 6th and then say, but we're not going to talk about what the FBI knew. We're not going to talk about what the Capitol Police did. We're not going to, I mean, I've told my audience, look, if you're the Capitol Police chief, who's no longer there, he's been replaced, and you get a call from the FBI saying there will be trouble on January 6th, be ready. I can't imagine him not picking up the phone and calling Pelosi, who is his boss, and saying, boss, the FBI says we're going to have trouble, and they should know. They've been tracking these guys for weeks. What do you want me to do? Now, she could claim, I never got the phone call, like Hillary Clinton claimed she never got the offer from the Pentagon to rescue people on, you know, on September the 11th, 2012 in Benghazi. She could say, I never got the call. I never heard the word. My underling, the police chief, never told me there was going to be trouble. And I'm even hard-pressed. I don't know whether the FBI warned Pelosi or not. But all of those questions, aren't they naturally going to come up? Even if she puts the biggest softballs like Liz Cheney on the committee, which I guess was her idea of replacing Banks and Jordan by saying, well, why don't you put Liz Cheney on there? She's reliably siding with the Democrats these days.
Yeah, that's right. That was the intent to, you know, sort of name check a Republican or two. But you're right. Look, there are questions from both sides on what happened. People on both sides want to see, you know, footage uncovered. They want to know more details about you know, who knew what, when, what happened, where the security failures were. There were obviously failures. People want to know what happened, but Pelosi only wants a one-sided narrative of of what happened. She clearly wants to make this a show trial, a Moscow trial. She wants to smear the President Trump. She wants to smear Republicans, lay it at their feet, and she wants to present things in the most advantageous light for Democrats, and she wants to score political points, not find answers. That's abundantly clear. And really, no Republican and no member of Congress should put up with this. This is a charade. It's a fake committee. It's a fake hearing. They shouldn't even participate.
Okay, so does McCarthy cave in at this point and say, okay, we'll put some members on the committee? Or does he stay back? And does Pelosi go ahead and run a committee with no Republican members?
It looks like to their credit, Republicans, including McCarthy, are taking, you know, we're not going to participate. We're not going to give you, we're not going to play into this charade. They are, they're removing themselves from the committee. I expect Liz Cheney will show up, you know, maybe Adam Kinzinger, who knows.
Oh, God.
But it's clear that, it's going to be essentially just Democrats, and Republicans are not going to play ball, to their credit.
Well, and Noah, just so you understand the rabbit hole, as I said, I'm not a big fan of conspiracy theories, but I've had people say to me, people outside the business, they say, why would Pelosi want that? I said, do you remember the signature event that happened because of the riot and because they said people died at the riot? A cop was murdered, hit in the head with a fire extinguisher. Not true. And all the rest of this. What did they use that for? They used it to launch an impeachment 2 weeks before President Trump was due to leave office, which had no other predicate to support it, and which was done so unconstitutionally, John Roberts wouldn't even take part in the trial in the Senate. And you say that gave her the excuse she wanted to say, now we must impeach him again. You know, and if it turns out that that excuse was based on her telling the Capitol cops, just show up, and when you're overrun, let them have the building. Then America knows it's a setup, and I think that's what happened.
Yeah, you know, these are the questions that we need to ask. You know, hopefully journalists will find out everything that happened. You know, clearly Pelosi's not going to go for it, but hopefully some journalists who actually care about the truth are going to find out what happened, find out exactly what happened from the inside. We know we can't trust what Pelosi is putting out on this. We know it's going to make Pelosi look good. That's about all we're going to know.
Well, maybe the great Don Lemon, praised last night by the president as the most informed journalist in the United States of America, maybe Don Lemon will dig in on this one and really ask those hard questions, or maybe not. Noah, I appreciate it would be a first. Did you have any reaction to Joe Biden's stumbling performance last night? Quickly.
it wasn't surprising. You know, we've seen him before. I watched the clip of him responding to a restaurant owner saying that he couldn't hire people, couldn't pay people. And Biden basically said, well, tough, you should pay him more. And then he went into a diatribe, a tangent about how his dead wife's father offered him his restaurant, and he didn't want to do it because he knew about his parents. It was all.
Noah, thank you. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. In this segment of the program brought to you by Nick Shivers. Go to nickshivers.com for an instant offer to sell your home immediately. No showing, no hassles. You pick the closing date. nickshivers.com for details. I've got a few things to say about something crazy that Joe Biden said last night, and more craziness to follow it today, and it involves the Second Amendment and your right to own a gun, and Joe Biden's steadfast denial that he wants to outlaw guns. And then last night and today, he admits he wants to outlaw guns. I'll give you the specific quote to understand why he's saying that. It is crazy. It doesn't really address violent crime. But before we do that, I want to go to your calls first at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. David, thanks for listening on the Radio Northwest Network. What's on your mind today?
Is this Lars?
Yes, sir.
Hi, fantastic. I just want to let you know after your last speaker, there's two reasons for why I believe that Nancy Pelosi is doing this. The number one is a total diversion of this committee that would start, that she would have all the help of the drive-by press all over the screen.
Yep.
And to eat up press time, 30 to 60 to 90 days. But she already has her verdict of her commission. Donald J. Trump would never be able to run for public office again.
But that's not the case. And David,
no,
I hate
that's
to
her verdict.
No,
that's
but
she
no,
wants.
But
this
but
is impeachment
David,
free.
David, she has no way to get to that goal. If that's truly her goal, then it's a fool's errand because she has no way to get there. There were two opportunities to deny Donald Trump the opportunity to ever run for public office again. The first time he was impeached. In early 2020, they had a trial in the Senate. If the Senate had voted by a majority to find him guilty, what's that?
I understand that he was found guilty as he was both times.
No, he was not found guilty. He was not found, sir, David. He was not found guilty. In neither case was he convicted.
I'm not saying he was. I'm saying he's not guilty.
Right. So in that case, the only time the Senate could then vote, it was the second vote they'd have to take. They'd have to first find him guilty, which they didn't, and then they would have to have a second vote on whether or not to deny that person the chance to ever run for public office again. And in both cases, they didn't do that. Her having a committee today can't change that.
I think she's still trying.
Well,
I
know,
what I'm
but
trying
but,
to say.
But David, I mean, I hate to disagree with you, but there is no way for her to reach that goal. I mean, if the entire
good.
House...
That's good news, then, because I think this is what she's actually trying to do.
Well, she's trying, then. She doesn't know the rules of the House of Representatives or the rules of impeachment, because the only way... And you can no longer impeach Donald Trump. In fact, I think the second impeachment of Donald Trump was unconstitutional because it came so close to his leaving office that there was no way... impeachment requires a trial, first impeachment by the House and a trial in the Senate. But they knew that the trial in the Senate would happen after he left office and that it was therefore unconstitutional. And I point to John Roberts, who refused to even take part in it, even though the Constitution says the trial in the Senate shall be presided over by the Chief Justice of the U.S. Supreme Court. And he said, I'm not doing it. Well, yeah, but it didn't stop them from going ahead and having a show trial, a star chamber trial, and yet it still ended with his acquittal. So
I'm saying Nancy Pelosi's trying this again, another version.
Well, okay, she can try all the versions she wants, but the rules don't allow her to get there. Now, I want to play a soundbite for you from what Joe Biden has said about what he plans to do with guns. Now, Biden has said over and over, I'm not trying to ban guns. I want you to listen to what he says, and then I'm going to read a quote to you. Take a listen to what he said about guns last night.
I'm continuing to push to eliminate the sale of those things, but I'm not likely to get that done in the near term. So here's what I've done. The people who, in fact, are using those weapons are acquiring them illegally. And so what happens is I've gotten ATF, alcohol, tobacco, and firearms, I have them increase their budget and increase their capacity, along with the Justice Department, to go after the gun shops that are not abiding by the law of doing background checks.
Now, here's the problem with that. Yes, it's on the books already. When I go to buy a gun, I fill out a Form 4473. It has to be filled out absolutely accurately. If the gunsmith I go to, and he's told me this, he says, Lars, you leave one box unchecked on this form and I submit it, they'll come and take my license. That's already the case. But Joe Biden is trying to make people believe that most of the criminals out there go to gun stores and buy their guns legally, or that the gun stores violate the law. And there are stores where somebody walks in who has a clean criminal record and they are buying a gun on behalf of someone else. And for years, I've been advocating that they throw the book at people who do that. The U.S. Attorney's offices typically will give these guys a couple of years in prison when they've committed the crime of a straw purchase multiple times, and they could be sent to prison for decades. I'm with Joe Biden on that. But that's not where most of the criminals are getting their guns. Most of the criminals are buying their guns from people who stole them from law-abiding citizens. So amping up the budget of the ATF is a great way to harass gun store owners and firearms merchants who are doing everything legally, but they leave a box unchecked. These are not gun store owners who are selling illegally. Joe Biden is gaslighting America. He's trying to make you believe, that if you only go out and punish the gun store owners enough, the criminals won't have guns. And Joe Biden, frankly, on that subject, is absolutely being foolish. You've got the Radio Northwest Network. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you, and I'm always glad to get your phone calls and emails. And welcome to the Radio Northwest Network, serving Oregon, Washington, and Idaho with honestly provocative talk on a daily basis. Now, I want to talk about critical race theory. And I know there's been a lot of controversy about this. It should be controversial because critical race theory is having public school teachers taught that they should treat kids differently based on their skin color. Now, if I only get to that point of the conversation and you say, hold on, aren't we supposed to be in a colorblind society where no matter where you are, you walk into a store, whether you're black or white or brown, you should be treated the same. Whether you're male or female, treated the same. Whether you're old or young, you should be treated the same. That's the law. It's the Constitution. And there are multiple laws at the federal, state, and local level that say you have to treat people the same. But now we're going to have public school employees who are going to be taught to look at everything through the lens of critical race theory, which says if you have white skin, you are part of the oppressor class. You are part of a systemically racist America that goes all the way back 400 years to 1619. Yeah, it was a bunch of claptrap sold off by a reporter, so-called, who did very bad research for the New York Times. But critical race theory goes further. It says the teacher should look at the kids and say, this child has white skin. This child is part of the oppressor class. This child has an advantage over all the kids with brown and black skin. Oh, and by the way, the kids with brown and black skin, they are the oppressed class. Not much is expected of them because, after all, they and their parents and grandparents have been oppressed for hundreds and hundreds of years. So if we don't manage to teach them very much, and sadly, there is a lot of minority student failure in public schools, well, then the teacher's off the hook. It's not my fault. It's from something that happened 400 years ago. Here's the thing. The Biden administration was right up to the edge of saying, we're going to push critical race theory. We're going to tell the Department of Education, the federal level, which provides a tiny percentage of the funding for your public schools. Most of it is local, thank God. That the federal government was going to say, we're going to push critical race theory, and we're going to tell school districts, if you're not compliant, if you're not telling kids about their white privilege and teaching them to be anti-racist, and Ibrahim Kendi, the biggest pusher of CRT, who says the only way to fix past discrimination is to discriminate against white people now, if you don't buy that, you aren't getting the federal grant. So, all of a sudden, the Biden administration is backed up hard. Back in May, they were talking about doing this. Now they're saying, well, they haven't completely abandoned it, because that's going to have quite a reaction from the left side of the political spectrum, from the Democrats. But it's also something that's being pushed at the local level, and that you see schools and school districts and school superintendents and principals sending out memos saying that we've got to have you go to your diversity, inclusion and equity training for teachers. And there we will teach you about critical race theory. So I wanted to play a couple of sound bites for you. There were people at a training. It happened in St. Louis in this case, but I have a feeling it is happening everywhere in America. And if you know about it in your local school district, please send me the information. If you're a teacher, I hope there are teachers who are troubled by this crazy idea. But this curriculum writing team at a suburban St. Louis school said, we want to put critical race theory out there, but listen to what one of the teachers says is the big challenge of using critical race theory. Take a listen.
Dr. King, one of the challenges that we run into, I mean, we're in a highly conservative county. I mean, we are in the middle of Trump country here. And anytime in my career when we've attempted with staff, attempted with kids, families to even touch on the concept of white privilege, we get just incredible amounts of pushback and furor. And what suggestions do you have for us?
Hey, how can we do this? How can we get away with pushing CRT? And he's talking to a guy, a consultant brought in by the district called LeGarrette King, who's an associate professor of social studies at the University of Missouri. And he's supposed to be, he was billed as a specialist in the study of race, critical theories and knowledge. And school board members had just approved Black History and Black Literature courses as high school electives. So guess what he turns around and tells the teacher to do? Take a listen.
If it's something where you have to not utilize verbiage of white privilege or, you know, whatever the case may be, then don't use the verbiage. But the point is the same.
Hold on. Now, did you hear what I heard? Because they're saying when we teach critical race theory, an awful lot of parents and teachers don't like it. And they say this is wrong to teach people, teachers, that they should treat people differently. Students in particular, tell a little 5 or 6 year old girl or boy, you have white skin, you're part of the oppressor class, you're part of a systemically racist America. Yeah, that gets pushback. So what does he do? He says, change the name, put a different name on it, but the point is the same. And listen to what he says about how to use words to get this done.
If you got to throw out the words, right? You know, somebody wanted to do that at the University of Missouri and rename our undergrad program or something like that. It was something, you know, teaching social justice or something like that. I'm like, do we really have to call it teaching social justice? Because all we're doing is bringing attention to ourselves.
So in other words, they're going to do it in a stealth mode. So these are teachers working with a consultant paid for by the school district to come in and show teachers this is the kind of propaganda that you're going to push on kids. And by the way, if you have to, call it something else so that you can hide what you're doing. But as LeGarrette King said, the point is still the same. I suspect that this is happening in most school districts in America. Maybe not every school district, but this is hugely dishonest. And you know what's happened. This is why about 6 months ago, you heard school districts all over the country talking about, oh, our plans for racial equity, for teaching diversity, inclusion, and equity, for teaching white privilege, you know, shaming kids because of their skin color. If you're white, you're bad. If you're brown or black, you are an oppressed, pathetic person from whom not much is expected. That kind of nonsense. And then saying, just hide it. Use different words to describe it, but still get the same point across. This is the kind of nonsense that parents and students, and I would say teachers too. I'll bet there are a lot of teachers out there right now, maybe even some listening to this, who are saying, I don't like this stuff. I think it's wrong. I believe in what Dr. King said, not LeGarrette King, but Dr. Martin Luther King, who said, you should judge people based on the content of their character and not the color of their skin. And now people like Ibram Kendi and LeGarrette King are turning that idea on its head. Do judge kids. Do judge your fellow teachers. In fact, judge yourself if you have white skin, whether you've done anything in your life that would constitute treating somebody badly because of their skin color, you are still a racist and you are defined that way because of your skin color. It is Joe Biden's 21st century Jim Crow. And it's being pushed in your schools. And I hope a lot of teachers and parents stand up and do something about it. Back in just a moment. Glad to get your calls. You're listening to the Lars Larson Show. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you, and I'm always glad to take your calls. Our Twitter poll today, and I think it's a good one, should the taxpayers ever fund a political advisor for an elected official? I'd say no to that. No, whether it's a Republican or a Democrat or an independent, and yet Governor Kate Brown of Oregon is on track to spend over $100,000 to keep one of her longtime advisors on the payroll in a no-bid state contract to go to weekly meetings of the Western Governors Association, which you might have imagined that members of the Western Governors Association, being governors of Western states like Kate Brown, you'd actually go to the meeting on your own. But I guess if you're Governor Kate Brown, you can pay somebody else to go. Let's go to first to Ron in Tacoma, who's listening on KVI, Talk Radio 570, and, of course, the Radio Northwest Network. Ron, what's on your mind today?
Well, I think we're at a point there, Lars, where we need to start pulling teeth, and I mean pulling a lot of them. I know you're pro-law enforcement.
I am.
To a fault sometime.
I don't think so. But,
I mean, I went out there for 15 years and put people in jail that deserved it, too. But you know what? I've seen a lot of discrepancies. And I'm going to
Hold on,
Lars,
Ron. What is a discrepancy? I'm not picking nits, but if you say there's a cop who broke department procedure, report him. If he broke the law, indict him. If he committed a crime, convict him. But that's been my stance all along. I said I always back the cops unless they break the law, and I would extend that to if they break department policy, the rules of their own department, then you should fault them. And if their training was bad, you should fault the department. And if the chief was bad, you should fault the politician, the city council, or the mayor who hired him. How is that being pro-cop to a fault?
Okay, well, that's not what I'm talking about. A lot of this stuff.
Well, then get to what you're talking about.
Okay, well, a lot of this stuff doesn't come out till years later. Usually many years later before you can do anything about it.
Oh, baloney! Come on, Ron. If you're gonna make those kind of no, if no, I'm not going to because you blathered on without getting to your point, Ron. Ron, I'll let you get there, but I keep encouraging you to get to the point. You keep saying, well, that's not quite my point. If you have a cop who broke the rule, hold on, Ron, I'm going to put you on. Yeah. Ron, I'm going to stop you because I'm going to make this specific. If you want to say a cop broke the rules on Thursday, then on Thursday afternoon or Thursday night or Friday morning, the person who was the victim of that rule breaking can go in and file a complaint. How does that come up years later?
Well, yeah. Put it this way, Lars. What has been proper about what's going on with law enforcement in the last, I don't know, since Donald Trump's lost the election?
What's been proper? They're still arresting criminals. The prosecutors may not prosecute, and that's a problem of Seattle and Portland and a lot of other big cities, but they arrest criminals. They keep the peace. They try to resolve things that are bad in a neighborhood, even where an arrest isn't necessary. How is that not exactly what the cops are supposed to do? Now, they've been defunded.
Well, that
the
is
cops.
What they're supposed to do. It's what they're not doing is the problem.
Then tell me what they're not doing.
They're enforcing politician rules. And, you know,
well, hold on. What is a Ron? I hate to keep having to ask you this, but what is a politician rule? You mean a law passed by legislators in Salem or Olympia or Boise? That's not a politician rule.
I don't know. I guess you're not going to let me get to my point.
Well, if you could get to it, do you need a map and a compass?
Yeah, I don't know. You're just not going to let me say what I got
to
say.
No, get to your point. Go ahead. And if you can get to the point, go ahead. I'll give you 30 seconds. Get to the point.
Wonderful. My point is we need to get extortion out of the law. We've got to stop allowing prosecutors and law enforcement to extort people to break cases. They've ruined, you know, they used to have the ability to do that, and they used to do it with respect and with dignity of the law.
What do you mean?
But
Ron, when you use these things and you don't tell, what is the extortion you're speaking at? You keep talking in generalities. Tell me what they're doing that constitutes extortion. I know what extortion is. Tell me how the cops are using it.
Look what they've done to people that they've recently picked up that were Trump voters. They've turned around and they've extorted these people into guilty pleas just so these people don't have to face 20 years in prison for
day one. Ron, hold on. This is where I thought you were going, but I had to guess because you spent 2 minutes getting there. If I get picked up and I have committed no crime, I'm not taking a plea. But if you've committed some crimes and they say, you know, you've got the choice. You want to go to trial and roll the dice? If you think we can't prove that you're guilty, go ahead. Then you're free to do that. But if you are a person who's accused of a crime and you plead guilty to the crime, what solution to that do you have?
There should be no solution. If you have a case, prosecute it. More of this extorting people into taking less.
Well, how is it extortion if somebody says to you, Ron, we think we can prove you're guilty of whatever it is, X. They say, Ron, we can prove it. And here's the problem. If they offer you, if you want to avoid a trial, which may come with heavier penalties, we will allow you to take a plea.
Now, that's the extortion
why?
Part.
If you're ready to learn, would you like to hear two practical problems with that? Number one,
Sure. If
you said we're going to try every single case, call up the prosecutor in Seattle. I'm willing to bet he considers 50,000 cases a year. 50,000 cases could not fit through the court system, period. It can't. So that would mean that you would end up either with people who never get prosecuted for actually committing crimes, because you'd have the charges dismissed. There's a speedy trial rule that says you have a right to go to trial. So if you said, we're going to try all 50,000 misdemeanors and felonies in King County in the next year, and you say, well, first of all, you're going to have to probably add tenfold to the prosecutor's office. You're going to add tenfold to the public defender's office, and you're going to have 10 times as many judges and courtrooms, because the system right now, as I understand the numbers, tries about 8-10% of all the cases, because the rest are resolved through guilty pleas, which has a benefit to the public because we get the certainty of conviction. It has a benefit to the accused, because if you're accused of 5 things, but they say, we'll let you plead guilty to 3 of them, and you get less punishment, but we get the certainty of a conviction, and the public avoids 50,000 trials, which we can't possibly accommodate. Everybody wins. Tell me who loses in that.
America loses in that, because you have only the people that are going to be prosecuted on the charges that are strong, those are the people that are going to be doing time.
No, do you know when people go to trial, Ron? When the charges are weak. If you have a strong Loctite case, you go out and stick a knife in somebody's heart. They die. You're caught with the knife in your hand and the victim's blood on the knife. That's a Loctite case. Now, you say, prosecute that one. Well, you could, except you might get a sympathetic jury, and then they turn you, the killer, loose. Instead, they say, we've got you dead to rights. Would you like to cop a plea? The punishment will be a little bit less. The times where there are usually trials are where the details are sketchy, and the person who's accused says, you know what? I don't think they can prove I'm guilty. Let's go to trial. So the weak cases go to trial. The strongest cases, you're caught at the wheel of a stolen car and you're accused of car theft, and they you're caught on camera committing a crime, and they say, do you want to go to trial or would you like to take a plea? Would you like us to show the jury the video of you committing the crime? And then they're going to send you to jail for a lot longer. I don't know what your beef is with the cops, Ron, but I would love to understand it. Maybe on First Amendment Friday. You're listening to the Radio Northwest Network. Welcome back to the program. Glad to have you on board. And if you want to jump into the best conversation in talk journalism, it's right here every day at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Emails go to talk@LarsLarson.com. Vote in my Twitter poll @LarsLarsonShow. And if you don't like Twitter, go to LarsLarson.com. You can vote just the same. I'll bet a lot of you are like me in that you suspect that all those folks out there, not me, but all those folks out there, politicians, who say, defund the police, give the mob in the streets what they want, that they are much more concerned about their own personal security than you are, and that while they're defunding the cops who protect you, they are probably amping up the amount of money they spend on their own personal protection. Well, the man who actually has the numbers for that and can prove the case is our great friend Adam Andrzejewski, who is the CEO and founder of Open the Books, which, if you suspect that's about public records and such, you understand what he's doing. He's also a columnist at Forbes.com. Adam, welcome back to the program after too long.
Great to be on the program, Lars. Thank you very much for your interest in our work.
I'm glad to be, because you bring the actual numbers. So let's talk about this. 25 major cities around the United States, almost all of them, if not all of them, are run by solid Democrat majorities, if not all Democrats, as mayors, city councils, and all that. Many of them have cut their police departments. In the case of New York City, it was $1 billion. I think in Los Angeles, it might have been $150 million. In other cities, it's tens of millions. They've cut the cops. Violent crime's gone up. Citizens suffer. But what about the personal security of those mayors and city councils?
Well, we found that the defunding of the police, coupled with taxpayer dollars spent on police security details, protected the public officials, the mayors. And this only occurred in cities run by Democratic mayors. San Francisco is a good example of this. In San Fran, the mayor's police detail today costs $1 million a year more than what it cost just 5 years ago. And the mayor, obviously in San Francisco, she cut the police budgets by $120 million. And I want to point out, Lars, that the police officers in San Fran, they're titled peace officers.
Wow. They're not even police officers. They are peace officers. So their job is peace. And I guess that does peace sometimes involve ever arresting anybody?
Well, look, you know, our auditors, we mapped 140,000 cases of human waste in the public way over a 9-year period, and those cases had spiked to an all-time high underneath this mayor's administration to 31,000 cases in the last year we checked. That was 2019. That's a human health catastrophe, and the police don't even arrest those homeless people anymore for pooping in city streets.
Now, this is crazy stuff, but you saw that there is a pattern, or you documented that there was a pattern, that even in the places where the officials, the elected officials said, we have to cut the police, that they amped up their own security budgets. Were there any exceptions to that rule?
So there's a transparency problem. We looked at 25 big cities. Look, the top 30 largest cities in America, there's only 3 Republican mayors. All 3 of those Republican mayors increased their police budgets, so that left a universe of 27 Democrat mayors in big cities. And 25 of those communities, they actually defunded their police. So we filed a Freedom of Information Act request with those 25 towns, and we've only heard back from 5 of them. And 20 of those big cities, they've admitted they have a special police detail for the mayor, but they haven't, even after 2 months, almost 10 weeks after we filed the request, they have not come through with the details. So the 5 towns that we're talking about, you know, one San Francisco, here's another one, Chicago, Illinois, Mayor Lori Lightfoot. We noticed in the city payroll, we counted the headcount of the police officers in 2020, and it was down 400 cops from 2019. Wow. Quietly, she defunded the police by cutting the headcount of rank-and-file officers on the street while the pandemic raged and while civil unrest loomed in the streets of Chicago. While the looting was national news, there was 400 fewer police officers on the street to literally defend the town that was under attack.
You know, Adam, there's another thing I'd love to see you check, because I think it gets into the details of this. There's a difference in the quality of security that city councils get. And let me tell you what I mean by that. This is happening in my backyard. I found out about it because I have some decent sources. There are at least a couple of city council members who get what's called a 900 box. Have you ever heard of that?
Well, I haven't heard of the 900 box.
Okay, here's how it works. Adam, if you at your home tonight picked up the phone and called 911, what happens? Do you get a cop there?
Yeah, it probably takes, in my community, 3 to 4 minutes.
And that's if you tell them something is happening, somebody's bleeding to death, somebody's been shot, you want to get them lights and siren, right? But if
that's
it's
right.
Busy, if they've already got all the units answering other calls, you might or might not get even 3 to 5 minutes. A 900 box, and I don't know how many cities are allowing officials to use these, but I know of 2 specific city council members who have these things. When they push that button, they don't have to call 911 and sometimes be put on hold. They are immediately dispatched 2 lights and siren cops to that address immediately. No hesitation, no nothing. They just press the button and two patrol cars come, lights and siren, because they assume it's an emergency. Now, I don't know of anybody outside of the elected elite who get that kind of treatment. You have to call 911. You have to explain the nature of the emergency, tell them where it is. They look at what's available. If they've got somebody available, they send somebody. If they don't have anybody available, eh. But if you've got a 900 box, this is like the traveling first class on the airlines. You get it right now, and you get it at lightning speed.
I wouldn't be surprised by that, Lars. And look, these mayors or those city council members, they need to explain why protection for the people matters less. Look, they're ramping up their own police security while they're cutting the police and defunding the police protection in the neighborhoods. And I think they've got a lot of explaining to do. For example, like in Chicago, with the 400 fewer police officers on the street, Lori Lightfoot's administration, they spent $750,000 more, $3.4 million, 22 officers were pulled out of the neighborhoods and put on official protection units for the mayor and other officials.
Well, you know, if people don't know this information, there's no way for them to fight back. But I'm hoping, Adam, that people take this information. You've got it up online so people can take a look if they're in one of the 25 top cities in America, right?
That's right. So that you could just Google Forbes, defund the police, Democratic mayors. My article comes right up. The complete study is published up there at Forbes.
Millions and millions of dollars spent every single year. And Adam, I'll say this because I know somebody is sure to object to this and say, well, Lars, you're not saying these people should have no security or the same level of security as just Joe Public out there. No, not necessarily. I mean, if you're in a position you've been elected to and you're going to draw some extra negative attention, in some cases dangerous attention, I think we should have some security for those people. But on the other hand, if you're telling the public that they're going to have to just simply accept the fact that when they call for the cops, response time is going to be longer, and every one of those cities I've looked into that have defunded their cops have longer response times, which means it may be you who's bleeding to death and you're waiting for emergency help, and it's slower in coming. And in that case, minutes actually could take lives. So I appreciate what you've done, Adam. We're going to send people in the direction of your columns and also of the work you've done for Open the Books. We really appreciate it. We're always glad to have you on the show.
Thank you, Lars. Thank you very much.
Glad to do it. That's Adam Njefsky. Don't try to spell his last name. Just looking up at Forbes. He's the founder of Open the Books. Back in just a moment. We'll get to your phone calls and emails at 866-439-5277. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's Conspiracy Theory Thursday, and I'm always glad to be with you. If you want to jump in, it's 866-HEY-LARS. Our Twitter poll today, and I will get to your calls if you're on hold. Should the taxpayers ever fund a political advisor for elected officials? I'd say no to that. Governor Kate Brown on track to spend $100,000 in a no-bid state contract to keep her political advisor on the public payroll. You know, if you're a politician, you should be able to make the decisions. That's the job you ran for. If you have to hire somebody else to advise you on how to make the decisions. Now, if a governor says, well, listen, I don't know that much about forestry. I'd like a forest advisor. Okay, I understand that. If you need somebody who's an expert in engineering or diseases or whatever, I get that. But there are usually state agencies that contain all those experts. But to have the taxpayers pay for somebody simply to give political advice to a politician who sought the office seems really, really wrong to me. Dear calls now, 866-439-5277. Oh, and by the way, this segment of the program is brought to you by Marquee Spas. I've been a fan of Marquee Spas for a long time. They give the ultimate hot tub and swim spa experience. Visit online or go to one of their three locations, MarqueeHotTubs.com. Now, let's go first to Ron. Hey, Ron, welcome to the Lars Larson Show. I take it you heard some of those sound bites from the critical race theory expert advising teachers how to go ahead and teach critical race theory, just put a different name on it, right?
That's right, Lars. I like what the previous person that you had on before the break. Both of those tie hand in hand. When you have a society, we go all the way back to the beginning of freedom and socialism under Wilson. Even during the Great Society times, where I lived through as a five-year-old kid in L.A., the reason I keep going back to where I grew up in L.A. is because I'm watching it happen throughout our country. If I keep saying a lie and saying, you're the black, you're the lowest thing, this, that, and all that, Then all of a sudden, you have law enforcement that used to be just like Andy Griffith when I lived out in South Central, and they get undermined and everything else. You know, they were people. They played dominoes. They had barbecues. They had the concerns. They would, last thing they would try to do is take you to jail. But they would give you chances. The problem is you can't go through it with a social worker and tie law enforcement hands and say, we're going to take care of the crime, but we're going to enable, but we're going to give ourselves an exemption to have our own police team like Maxine Waters did and other people in L.A. City Council. And look at, I mean, look right in Portland. Look at Eugene. Look at possibly Salem now. The point is you cannot go through and discourage people because of their race of something that happened 150, 300 years ago. All of us, and Lars, here's the dirty secret Democrats hate to hear. Whether it's Native Americans, blacks, whites, Italians, Jews, Germans, Japanese, or the Chinese to help make the railroad. Guess who that was under? And who was always big corporation, big sugar trust, railroad trust, oil trust, tea trust? All of them lined up together with the Democrat Party over the last 210 years. And they don't want to bring that secret out, because if you have knowledge, Lars, and if you're black and you're not part of the collective of Lightfoots or Maxine Waters or Sharptons or Farrakhans, then you're the outsider. You're the house trash that they don't think that you belong to. And what they're trying to do to our kids is say, oh, first grader or kindergarten, your ancestors caused this problem. You should be guilty of this. Bullshitter. No way in Hades that we, the people, should tolerate this. We, no. The people, need to hold them accountable. Period.
Well, I'm with you, Ron, because I would suggest to people that when you hear folks saying, we need you to teach this stuff, but you have to call it something else. Because we understand if we call it by the name that we've all called it by, critical race theory, then people are going to get upset. So you call it mother pie and apple pie and motherhood. You call it warm and fuzzy. You call it the fuzzy puppies curriculum. And when you decide that something is that important that it must be taught, but you have to constructively lie to the public and to the parents and to the kids and say, oh, we're not teaching critical race theory. And then you give it some other name that sounds more warm and fuzzy. If you have to lie about it, wouldn't you think that education professionals would say to themselves, I'm either going to teach people, I'm going to teach my kids this, and I'm going to tell the parents. If the parents say, what are you teaching? I'm teaching them math. I'm teaching them science. I'm teaching them reading, writing, and arithmetic. Okay. If you have to change the name of something so that you can hide what it really is, I mean, sex ed's been controversial all the way back to when I was in high school. Okay, fine. We had pretty basic sex ed, you know, some stuff that was, you know, in some ways kind of funny, but whatever. But they called it what it was, sex education, like physical education or math or science. If you have to hide what it is from the people who are paying the bill and from the people who are sending their kids there, you probably shouldn't be teaching it, because all you're saying is, I can't actually tell. It reminds me, Ron, of that soundbite we ran about a year ago when remote learning first started. And there was a teacher in Philadelphia, and she blew a gasket saying, we can't let the parents see what we're teaching their kids. And I thought, that should be your first clue. If you say, I have to hide from the parents what I'm teaching their kids, you know you're doing something wrong. And I wish, I keep hoping, because I get a lot of grief for being critical of the education system and sometimes of teachers. And they say, well, you don't like teachers. I love teachers. I mean, my mom was dead. My dad was a boozer. And teachers were my best friends for a lot of my life. But if you've got teachers who are, say, I'm proud of the profession I'm in, good. Are you lying to the parents about what you're teaching their kids? If the answer is yes, or even close to yes, then you should stand up and say to your union and your principal, I am not going to teach this garbage to the kids. If you're proud of it, then stand up and tell us what it is. And if you're teaching little white kids and brown kids that they have to be evaluated based on their skin color, you are a Jim Crow racist. You got the Lars Larson Show.